Now, and well, almost maybe coming to the end of it. I hate to say it because it's mid-August, but trust you're enjoying the heat. I'm enjoying the relief from the heat today. I am not a heat person, and so having been born and raised in Winnipeg, I'm all for the cold. So I'm finding some rest and refreshment, and I hope that you're doing the same through these summer months. Often this is a time when we can get some vacation and take a little bit of a break from our regular routine. This summer, as you know, we're walking through the Psalms, and in a way, we're taking a bit of a master class in prayer, because that's what the Psalms are. The Psalms are really prayers to God. And so as we study these writings, it's my hope and my prayer that you are growing and nurturing a deeper prayer life week by week. This is a great opportunity to do that, to see how the Psalms frame prayer, to see the language, to see the subjects that are addressed. It's a wonderful opportunity for us to learn in that. So be doing that. Pray at home. Pray at work. We've prayed here. Pray everywhere. Pray constantly. Pray, for that is the language with which we interact with God. One of the great prayers in the Bible to learn from is Jesus' great prayer for his disciples in John chapter 17. And when you read that prayer, it's hard not to be reminded of what we've just been reminded of, that we are in the midst of a great battle, that we are engaged with an enemy, and we must not forget that or avoid that. I wonder if you felt that battle with the enemy this past week. For myself, it's good for me to be reminded of this. I have to confess, not a lot of my prayers typically have battle language in them. I need to work on that, because that is exactly what we're involved in. We are in this incredible cosmic battle. This is our reality, and we need to address that in our prayers. And as we return to the Psalms today, we're reminded of this conflict, maybe in a new way. We're in Psalm 16 today, so if you have your Bibles, I'll ask you to turn there, whatever form you have. Psalm 16 is really a psalm about sanctuary. It's a psalm that reminds us that we all need rest and refuge and a safe place where we can go. Do you pray for that? Do you recognize your need for that? I like to think of it this way: as we strive to live out the Christian life, we need to realize that we're not so much like a strong tower as we are more like a rubber duck. Maybe you've not thought about yourself that way, but I want you to think about yourself as a rubber duck this morning. I've been thinking about that after reading about a cargo ship that left Hong Kong in 1992, bound for the U.S., and while en route, this ship hit really rough seas, and several of the shipping containers that were on the ship fell into the water. They were washed overboard. And one of these containers contained 28,000 plastic bath toys, rubber ducks, turtles, frogs, all of that kind of thing. So the container broke open, and these rubber ducks just went into the ocean. From there, they began to travel. Some of the lucky ones ended up in Hawaii. Others made it to the shore of Alaska. Some were beached in South America, Australia, and the Pacific Northwest. Some have even been found frozen in Arctic ice. Others made their way to Scotland and Newfoundland, even into the Atlantic. But those were the fortunate ones. Several years ago now, there were still some over 2,000 of these toys bobbing around in the North Pacific. They were stuck in a vortex of currents that just goes round and round and round. And in fact, that current is home to a huge trash heap of ocean debris about the size of Texas. And it just keeps going round and round and round. Occasionally, some of these ducks are able to break free. But it doesn't just happen. The ducks aren't able to do it themselves. it requires some outside force to release them from this vortex. Might be a shift in the wind, might be a storm that blows through, might be a marine animal that takes an interest in one of these ducks and pushes it outside of the pull of the current. But if not for an outside influence, the ducks would stay trapped in this floating trash vortex forever. That's us. That's you and me. We are in the midst of this great spiritual conflict, tossed about by these great forces, so great I think we cannot fully imagine them. We are adrift in a storm of events and influences, and we need help. We need some kind of outside force beyond us to be our anchor and to help us break free from the influences of these forces against us. The psalm that we're reading today is about exactly where we find that anchor, exactly where we find that refuge that can take us through the storms of life. We are in Psalm 16 today, and we are reading about sanctuary. So if you're with me, we are in Psalm 16, and we'll just start with the first couple of verses. Keep me safe, my God, for in you I take refuge. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. Apart from you, I have no good thing. This psalm was written by King David, the ruler of God's people. We're not exactly sure when in his life David wrote this psalm. It may have been during a time of great personal peril. David was a man who had plenty of people, plenty of nations that would have liked nothing more than to see him dead. So it's very possible that he wrote this psalm in a time of great personal risk. It's also possible that he wrote it in a time of peace, anticipating a time when he was going to need God's help, because that came about pretty regularly. In either case, this is a word from God here, written by a man who understands his need for refuge. David, in a sense, is a refugee in search of help and a home. Let me just say, before I go any further here, that we're not really ready to hear this word from God unless, when I say the word refugee, you're saying to yourself, that's me. If you're not doing that, then I don't think any of the rest of what I have to say is going to mean much. We are sitting in a room full of refugees. We inhabit a spiritually alien and hostile land. And unless we understand our own limitations and even our own spiritual helplessness, unless we can say with the Apostle Paul that we are powerless, and nothing good lives in us but by the grace of God, then what we're going to read in the rest of this psalm isn't really going to resonate at all. God is calling us to his sanctuary, but unless we are broken and unless we see our need for that, we're not going to hear his message for us today. David, in his brokenness and his need, finds his answer in God. Now, what does that mean? David's going to expand on that in the rest of what we're going to read. And the first thought he has here is that God is the provider of all good things. Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. That doesn't mean we are never in life without needs or wants. It doesn't mean that we will not suffer at times. It does mean that God will grant us all that we need in accordance with his perfect will for us. And as the supreme creator, he is the giver of all good things. David affirms his conviction in this wonderful, good God. And he has a deep and profound trust in God's supernatural, sovereign provision for him. Now, I wonder if you're asking the question that usually comes to me when even I say something like that. What about all the people in this world, maybe even the people that live right beside us, who are in absolutely desperate, desperate need? What about those who are starving? What about those who are suffering? Doesn't that verse or these verses apply to them? That's a good question, and I'm sure we all struggle with it. And as I was wrestling with this passage some time ago, it occurred to me that maybe I should ask someone who has suffered want, frankly, a lot more than I have in my life, growing up in the place where I live. So I asked a friend of mine. His name was Paul. He came from Ethiopia. Ethiopia, you know, is a country that has been devastated by war and famine and poverty. And I asked him, when an African Christian reads these words, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," what does he think? What does he think about this promise that God's provision will be there for us? And this is what he told me. He said, when it comes to Ethiopia, his experience, you have to be very careful to distinguish between those who truly believe in Christ and those who simply pay lip service to him, saying one thing and doing another. Communism entered into Ethiopia, God was all but forgotten, and the nation was ravaged. But the true church there today, Paul would say, is not a church which has forgotten God. Their testimony today is that God is providing for them. Paul told me, yes, there are problems. There is hunger, but God's people are not starving. The problem they see around them, they are convinced, are evidence of God's hand calling the nation back to him. There's a godly and a higher purpose, they are certain, for all this calamity. And the thing Paul talked about most is that the church in Ethiopia is really expecting Jesus to come back. They are waiting for him. They expect that to happen. And as they wait for that, far from being overwhelmed, far from becoming bitter, far from becoming cynical at these promises, they see God at work. And they trust in him for their provision. And they see God move. Paul told me stories of the blind who can see, the lame who can walk again. These things are happening today in Ethiopia. And in his great and grand purpose then, God, it would seem, has allowed suffering for a time, but God is also working. And the people there trust in him. They trust, like David does here, in his great provision and in his great plan. And in doing that, they find their sanctuary and their refuge in him. Let's keep reading. Verse 3. I say of the holy people who are in the land, they are the noble ones in whom is all my delight. I want to suggest, secondly, that to find sanctuary in God is to find shelter and relief in the people of God. David seems to have this sense that God's glory rests upon his people. God bestows his honor and his nobility to them, and it's in their midst, then, that we can see and observe God at work. And when David talks about these noble ones, he's not talking about people who are perfect. He's not talking about people who have it all together, who do everything right. None of us are like that. We would never claim that. But what he is convinced about is that there is nevertheless something of the glory of God in his people. It may be in some cases fleeting that we can see it, but it's there to be found. And it's in this realization that David sees that his sanctuary and refuge is with God's people. John Calvin, a great theologian of the 16th century, once said this: "We ought highly to value and esteem the true and devoted servants of God, and to regard nothing as of greater importance than to connect ourselves with their society. And this we will actually do if we wisely reflect in what true excellence and dignity consist, and do not allow the vain splendor of the world and its deceitful pomps to dazzle our eyes. This, I would say, is a word for us today. We are far too easily dazzled by the splendor of the world around us. God says, you want to see glory? Look for it in my people, because I am there with them. I love the story of Father John Sergeyev. He was a priest in Kronstadt, Russia. Mark Buchanan talks about this in his book, Your Church is Too Safe. And he talks about how in the mid to late 19th century, this was a time when Russia was crumbling from the inside out. It was a dangerous place to live. The streets were dangerous, rife with poverty and depravity. Crime was everywhere. Alcoholism was rampant. Thieves lined the alleys. There really was no safe place to be. But every day, Father John put his robes on, and he would go out into the streets, and he would look for the most hopeless soul that he could find, whether that it was in an alleyway or a gutter or any place like that. And he would find the person lying there, and he would take his chin in his hand, and he would raise that person's face to look into his eyes. And he would say to them, this is beneath your dignity, for you were created to house the glory of God. God's glory rests on his people. And it is because of that, that it is in their midst that we find God and we find his sanctuary and his refuge for us. Verses 4 to 6. Those who run after other gods will suffer more and more. I will not pour out libations of blood to such gods or take up their names on my lips. Lord, you alone are my portion and my cup. You make my lot secure. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. One last way that David understands God to be a refuge is that God for David is his sanctuary to the exclusion of all others. There's no other option here. It's just him. David sees others casting their lot with other gods. He sees other peoples pouring out libations, or what that means is just, it could be blood, it could be water, maybe poured on an altar, making these offerings to other gods, looking for blessing and sanctuary. And David says, there's no worth in that. There's only one God. There's only one place to find sanctuary. And that's why I'll have nothing to do with any of these other practices. And David borrows language from the conquest of the promised land back in ancient times when God brought his people to the land he had promised them. Each of the tribes of Israel was given an allotment of land for as their inheritance. And this would be God's great blessing to his people. But the priests got no land. In Numbers chapter 18, verse 20, God tells Aaron, you will have no inheritance in their land, nor will you have any share among them. I am your share and your inheritance among the Israelites. God would be their refuge. And David, in a similar way, is saying, God is my refuge. He alone is the one in whom I can find safety and sanctuary. This is really a culmination of all that he's been saying. There's only one place to find this, and that's in God alone. Well, what does this sanctuary really mean? What practical help can that give us? He starts to talk about that in the verses that remain, and we'll close with these. Verse 7, David says, I will praise the Lord who counsels me. Even at night, my heart instructs me. The first thing David is able to find in this God who provides sanctuary is guidance, is wisdom. The words used here are important. David says that God will counsel me. There's kind of this idea of guidance and wisdom, but it's a little stronger than that. He says God will instruct me is another way. There's maybe a little bit of a correction there. There's a little bit of rebuke. I can see as he's writing this, David is maybe, and maybe you've done this, he's lying awake at night and he's got this problem weighing on his heart and his mind. He doesn't know what to do about it. And he's tossing and turning and he just doesn't know what the answer is. And David says in those moments, God will be the one who guides and instructs me. There is this wonderful trust, this childlike dependence on this God that will lead and direct him. Do you trust God like that? Do you seek his wisdom for you? Do you have that confidence that he will provide it for you? Do you go to God when you have need of that direction? One of the ways I think that we need to look to God for wisdom and direction is really a combination of things. We get his guidance from his word that speaks to us. We can get his guidance from his people. And we get his guidance, we receive it when we come to him with a childlike trust that he will provide it. One of the greatest examples I have seen of this, of how these things all work together, is a description I read some time ago of the way in which the Christian church in Egypt selects the national leader for the church in Egypt. Okay, so they're picking the leader of the entire church in that nation. And the way they do it is this way. They solicit nominations from the people in the church. And in this one particular year that I read about, they had 17 people that were nominated. And then a nominating committee was formed, and they whittled that down to 5 people. And then they invited over 2,400 people from the church across the nation to vote on those 5 people, and they whittled it down to 3. Then the church entered into a time of prayer and fasting for a significant amount of time. And after they had done that, they gathered together in a cathedral in Egypt. And they put the 3 names in a jar. They took a young child. They blindfolded him. And the young child reached into the jar and picked out a name. And whatever name he picked out, that was the national leader. That's an interesting way to pick your leaders. I wonder if we could do that. I don't know. I'm not sure it would fly here. But isn't there in this method this wonderful combination of the wisdom of the people speaking into the process, and then at the end, this childlike trust, if you will, that God will ensure that his choice will lead the people. David has this combination, this confidence, this trust that God will guide him through whatever he might face. And because he has that, God is his sanctuary. Verse 8, I keep my eyes always on the Lord. With him at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Wouldn't we all love to say that? I will not be shaken. No matter what comes to me, I will stand. David is able to say that. And the reason he can say that is because he imagines God right there with him. This standing at the right hand is imagery that speaks of God being ready to go to battle for him. He's ready right there to help him. It's maybe reminiscent of a court or a military term, but God, the meaning is that God is there to provide any aid that he might need. And David in that finds great stability and trust. He can stand because he knows God is there with him. The Apostle Paul talks about this in Ephesians chapter 6, where he encourages the followers of God to put on the full armor of God, the belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness, the gospel of peace, the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit, standing in the strength that God can provide. Again, this is David's confidence. Because he has that conviction, God is his sanctuary. Verses 9 and 10. Therefore my heart is glad and my tongue rejoices. My body also will rest secure, because you will not abandon me to the realm of the dead, nor will you let your faithful one see decay. The final point this morning is that God is our sanctuary because it is in Him that we find life. Not just physical life, but spiritual life as well. David knows that his body may go to the grave, but it will not be left there. In other words, as he seeks God as his refuge, he's confident that death will not be the end of his relationship with God. He will live on because of what God has done for him. This morning, we're going to approach the table of communion and remember that this confidence that David had could be ours as well. I'm going to ask those who are helping with communion this morning if they will make their way to the stations that we have set up in our sanctuary today. There are various stations around the room, and